I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Philip Wynne joins me now. His debut short story collection, The Forbidden Purple City, has just been published. It features nine stories that have such rich characters that take the reader through East Vancouver to Vietnam, Korea, and the United States. Mr. Wynne's characters cover different aspects of the Vietnamese diaspora. We see familiar relationships between sons and fathers, friends, lovers, and folks who might seem familiar as having been read through folk tales. The book has already gotten great notices lauding the author for his skill as a writer and his compelling characters. Philip Wynne was born in Vancouver to parents who had fled Vietnam during the Civil War. His work has been published in various literary journals, including the Journey Prize Anthology. He is the winner of the Open Season Award from the Malahat Review and the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop Emerging Writers Award. He's a practicing lawyer. The Twitter handle is @PCHwin. The book is published by Goose Lane. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Philip Wynne. Mr. Wynne, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Thanks for coming in to do this. Where did you grow up?
Well, I did most of my early growing up actually in East Vancouver. I was actually born in St. Paul's Hospital, which I saw in the news has been recently put up for sale.
Yeah.
Sadly. But East Vancouver, the area around between Knight Street and Fraser Street, actually, were my original haunting grounds.
So I live where we're speaking from today. It's Fraser and King Edward area. And so, and then I went to elementary school at Charles Dickens, which
right.
is at Glen and, I guess, Glen and Kingsway area.
Sure.
And so when Goose Lane had booked the interview before I'd even opened the book. And so I started reading the book, and then I was just delighted to see this area that I still live in, that I grew up in, reflected in your writing. What compelled you to do that in terms of, say, setting your story, setting your characters amongst this
area?
East Van, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to hear that it resonated with you. East Vancouver is the place where I grew up, and it certainly is simply the wellspring of many of my stories. Perhaps not literally, but certainly psychically, and it's the place where I got many of my first images, made my first friends. My family grew up here back in the day, back in the 70s and 80s.
And that's the other neat thing about reading about this area is that because it is set a few years back now, one realizes just how it's changed a great deal.
It's changed so much. It changed so much. I mean, East Vancouver, it used to be just the first stop, in a way, for many new immigrants,
mm-hmm.
My family included. I mean, my family had recently arrived from Vietnam, and they were able to cobble enough money to buy a house in East Van. I think, you know, proverbially it was something around like $20,000.
Something like that, yeah.
I cannot imagine that happening today. I mean, East Van is sort of like a place of aspiration now for professionals.
Yeah. So you don't live in the... And you also, since that time, when you grew up here, you ended up going to, I think, was it Winnipeg?
I did. I actually lived in several places. Back in the early 80s, when I was growing up in East Van, every so often, I would go down to Iowa City and live for a few months, where my father actually was a graduate student.
Mm.
I was the son of a starving student until I was 12 years old, and we lived down in Iowa City for a while. And then my mom would get pregnant with one of my younger siblings and realize, wait a second, we have no health care down here.
Yeah.
All the family support is up here in Canada, and particularly in Vancouver, and then we'd move back to East Van.
I read the Iowa part, and then I thought you went to school there for writing.
I didn't. I wish my connections to Iowa City, Iowa, where there's an amazing writing program, actually predate me even knowing how to spell. I was there since you know, every so often since I was three, since my dad was a graduate student down there.
And then so you went to high school in Winnipeg, is that right?
I eventually did, yeah. After my father graduated in Iowa City, he landed a job as a professor in Winnipeg, and so we'd picked up and moved to Winnipeg. But Vancouver has always been home for me, even if I had spent a year or many years away from home, and I would leave Vancouver for a few months, maybe even a few years, but I would always yo-yo back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case with Winnipeg. I'd spent a few years there, and then when I graduated from high school, I went back to UBC.
Okay, so you went to UBC, and then you went to law school.
At UBC, yeah.
At UBC, and then you mentioned just before we started, you'd lived in New York for a spell as well, right?
I did. Yeah. I practiced law after going to UBC in New York City, where I was there for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I started my practice actually just around when 9/11 occurred. So I was actually in an apartment in Lower Manhattan on the day I was evacuated. My firm did put me up at the Swiss Hotel.
Uh-huh.
And some of those elements are in one of my stories.
Right. I'll have to ask you if you know of a good chicken place I guess it would be in Greenwich Village.
You know what? The good chicken places I know are probably in market stalls in Chinatown, but I'll get you some names.
And I bring that up because that's an element in the story Turkey Day. I'm asking you about where you have lived over the years, where you grew up and so on, because that's an element in the book, a theme in the book. Some of these characters are looking for where they belong, I mean, not just physically and geographically, but, you know, other aspects, say friends and family. Is that something that I don't know if you've contended with it, but it seems like you're acutely aware of it. And is it because of all these places that you've been over the years?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Some of my characters are certainly looking for a place to belong, whether it's in a totally new country, you know, whether it's in Canada, the United States, where some of my characters have moved to, or even from one Asian country to another. Some of them are looking for a place to belong and are immigrants, so to speak, even within their own city. I have a story called Mayfly involving a person who is an outsider to an ethnic group, particularly a Vietnamese group, and he eventually proverbially immigrates into that group as an outsider. Belonging, looking for a place to belong is certainly a touchstone of my stories. Also, I think the question of how do I belong in a place where I didn't necessarily choose is also a theme.
Yeah, see, that's something that growing up, where I did, I don't know if I really even thought about it. And it's only until, you know, as I get older, that I wonder how I got through what I got through.
Yeah.
Without having to think that. But, I mean, that's something that a lot of people have to contend with. And in high school especially, yeah, in those years, growing up, elementary school, high school, college years, I mean, those are such important years.
Yeah.
That they affect the person so much.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what you said a little earlier about maybe the fact that I did move around quite a bit while my father was a graduate student when I was younger made me more sort of sensitive to that issue. Because, you know, I write about immigrants, broadly speaking. I'm not, I'm not technically an immigrant myself, certainly not here in Vancouver. I was born here. But when I was a kid, I moved back and forth between here and then the United States. So I think I've developed a bit of an immigrant sensibility from an early stage. You know, like you, I have kids who are born and raised here and lived in the same place all their lives, and I don't think they necessarily have that self-consciousness about belonging that I had, for better or for worse.
And I guess I realize now, as I'm 37, maybe I've just ignored it because I guess it was around me. I suppose that's how people looked at me, and I'm sure that's the same with you.
I was quite self-conscious, but perhaps a bit more unconsciously so as an outsider when I was a kid growing up, just because I lived in places like Iowa City where, it's not quite, or wasn't back then, quite as diverse as a place like Vancouver now. But I didn't do anything consciously with that self-consciousness until probably like after high school. You know, it's only, and then you go through all these like really intense experiences in high school. You don't know what the source of these changes are, right? Whether they're internal or external. It was only after I graduated from high school, went into the wider world, that I started actually pursuing some of these thoughts more rigorously.
Yeah, and do you think it's just because you've reached a certain age that you have the maturity to even think about these things?
I think so, because I think it takes a bit of humility to do that, to kind of acknowledge that maybe you are an outsider and you always will be.
Yeah.
And it's a certain humility that you may not have immediately, and that you know, it's sort of like, you know what, it is what it is, right? I will never be part of the majority, whatever that means. And you know, let's deal with what I am and what I have.
Now, you studied law. You are practicing. That's your day job, I guess.
That is
your calling card. Did you always want to write, though? I mean, growing up, like everybody else, telling stories or hearing stories is something that we've all grown up with. Yeah. Writing them for you, I mean, was that something you wanted to do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't remember the first story I wrote, but I do remember writing stories when I was 7 years old in second grade in East Vancouver, actually at Fleming School.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a bit of an anecdote. I used to write these stories. I remember my teacher reading them to my classmates and them laughing. And she actually, when I was in second grade, she took me upstairs to the fifth grade class to have me read my stories in front of like 10 years old. And I was like, wow, this is incredible. They're listening to me read and they're laughing. Anyway, I think I did something extremely naughty once in class, because my teacher then, I do remember her hauling me up to that fifth grade class one day, standing me in front of the whole class and saying, he's not reading to you today. He's standing in front of you to apologize for his behavior. I don't remember the stories I wrote, and I don't remember what I did, so plead ignorance.
Even when you're pursuing your professional career and you're studying for that, and you're working as a lawyer, was writing something that you did off the side of your desk, say, and in your spare time and all that?
Yeah, it's something that I came back and forth to. It was just a passion of mine from very early on. I was English lit major in undergrad and took a couple of creative writing courses. Unfortunately, I never went and actually got an MFA. Went to law school and said law school was kind of the family business. I have relatives who are lawyers, and that's a part of me as well. It was actually, I left writing for many years when I was particularly practicing in New York, just because, you know, the stories about New York lawyers kind of working 9 to 5, 9 a.m. to 5 a.m. are kind of true. And so you'd work hard, you play hard, you know, I'd work, you know, knock off at 6 p.m. to go to a Broadway show, have dinner, then come back to the office after.
And work more.
But ironically, now that I'm married with kids, I'm still a lawyer. Not working in New York anymore. Somehow I've managed to find a bit more time, partly because, you know, you're older and I'm not socializing as much, and when the kids go to bed, I have a bit of time to focus on my writing.
What brought you back to Vancouver after, say, 7 years and on the East Coast especially?
You know what? Again, I've always thought of Vancouver as home, and no matter how many years I've spent away from it, I spent after law school in my early to mid-20s, to late-20s actually, in New York City, and then moving to Toronto for a couple years. As much as I love those places, I've always felt that ultimately Vancouver is my home. So I'm not one of those people who consider themselves stateless or don't have a place that they belong to. I certainly feel that I have a home. Fortunately for me, I was able to convince my wife to come with me. So my wife, who I met in New York City, mm-hmm. and who's a Buffalo gal herself. Mm-hmm. So it's what compelled me. I still have many of my family and friends here.
And I read in an interview you gave elsewhere, coming back here as often as you did, you realized just how quickly everything changed and how different everything was between visits.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's breathtaking how so much more diverse and how, you know, there's also a lot of growing pains I discover with Vancouver, with the growth, with the prominence that it has relative to the rest of the world. The fact that it's such a crossroads between Asia and North America, but there's a lot of tension points that come up with that, you know. Never mind just like housing prices.
Sure.
Prices. I mean, that's the obvious one. I think, and you know, I might have said this before somewhere else, that I'm not sure if I would have the same sensibility as a writer if I grew up today in Vancouver, because. Even back then, obviously, Vancouver was very diverse during the 70s and 80s. But I was born in, like, 1975 in Vancouver, and the Vietnamese community particularly was extremely small back then. The first waves of boat people, I think, didn't come until at least, like, 1977, 1978, and then 82.
Yeah.
And so it was very poignant to me how relatively isolated my family was as Vietnamese people.
Yeah.
In Vancouver and North America in general.
Yeah, you in a way, I know this is fiction, it's almost like a time capsule, if you will, for that era. Did you view it that way?
I think you're absolutely right. And the only thing I'm struggling to answer with is whether I view it that way now, which I certainly do, or whether I also viewed it that way when I started writing.
Mm.
I think after writing a few of the stories, I started noticing that I was writing about Vancouver in a certain way, and I might have been a little bit more self-conscious of that in later stories. What I mean to say is that, you know, I started realizing, look, the Vancouver I'm writing about has no cell phones, no internet.
Yeah.
Different place and time.
Yeah.
And you know what? Not having those communication devices is actually quite convenient for on a plot perspective, but then I realized that there was another sort of effect of that was kind of to have these things like sort of frozen in time.
Yeah, it's almost quaint, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
East Van is not only the area that these stories are set in. You take us to the remarkable places in Vietnam and elsewhere. Did you have to go to some of those places to write about them?
I've been to all of the places.
Yeah. You're not just looking at it on YouTube as one character does in the book.
Well, that's funny. That's funny you mention it. Like, certainly my orientation is as a North American, and so when I write about the North American locales, it is more so as the local. Some of my characters are unself-conscious about being in North America. Some of them feel a little bit trapped and wondering, how did I end up here? I find, like, in the stories that I wrote about Asia, all of the characters, whether they originally came from Asia or just visiting, are a lot more starkly outsiders. And I think that reflects my sensibility. The story that you mentioned about the guy looking through the internet at Vietnam, it's The Forbidden Purple City, actually. It's a story that my whole collection takes a name from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, although I wrote about a character who grew up in Vietnam, he is now living in Vancouver decades later. He drives a cab, and he's looking back on his homeland through the internet and seeing how much it's changed and seeing it as an outsider would. And I think it was kind of a character that was convenient for me to write, because that's how I see Vietnam, as a sort of like a place of fascination and curiosity. Even though I've been there, I've been to Royal City and to Hoi An.
And the other thing I was just thinking about, like everybody else in this town, you go along Kingsway and you walk past all these shops with all those posters on the wall of concerts that have happened or that are happening. And one of the things that I was struck by, every time I see these things, there's just a million people on the bill.
Yeah.
And it's Vietnamese music that they perform.
Right.
And you talk about that in one of the stories in the book.
Right.
About what that means.
Yes.
How powerful it is for some people.
Oh, it's extremely powerful. For many people, those concerts are the one continuing connection to a past that they've left. My parents are still in Winnipeg, and I don't think they're able to see as many of these concerts. They just don't have as many in Winnipeg.
It's just easier for Vietnamese artists to come here than...
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of Vietnamese art. It's a very vibrant sort of scene and stopover for artists in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them actually come from California. Less so in Winnipeg. So my parents, and particularly my mom, still rent CDs,
yeah,
to watch it on TV. And it's powerful, these shows, because it is done in a variety format.
Yeah.
And so it's like the stereotype, it's like, of the Vietnamese person. When I come and visit you, I just don't come. I bring my whole family with me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a metaphor for these types of concerts. There's all different styles, from like new wave to rock to the old style Vietnamese Gai Leng, like,
yeah,
the Vietnamese traditional music. And it's all jumbled together like in a big salad, which is great because these concerts attract people with not only different musical tastes but also different generations,
and so
it becomes like a family gathering place, and I found that fascinating. Yeah, I certainly wrote about that in the Forbidden Purple City.
The other thing we're talking about, places that you set these stories in, when you're writing about a place like the Forbidden Purple City, or New York City, or East Van, even as we've already talked about. How does that change your memory of the place, especially when you turn it into fiction, as you do?
Well, that's that is a fascinating question. Hopefully, what it does, it makes me see the place more precisely. I haven't been back to New York City since, for example, since 2008. But by virtue of writing about it, I just started reliving like the smells and also just the subway paths,
yeah,
that I took.
Yeah.
It also made me realize like how memory is just so faulty. I mean, just as a silly example with subway paths, I realized like the subway connections that I was writing about didn't actually work out in real life. And so I had to do all this like research on the MTA website,
yeah,
just to put it back together again. And sort of like the same thing happened actually when I was writing about Winnipeg, a place that I still visit, mm-hmm, occasionally, but haven't lived in since the 90s. I wrote about these places that the characters went to, and I published in Prairie Fire, which is the local literary magazine,
right,
in Winnipeg. And I got an email from the editor-in-chief saying, I enjoyed the story, but you can't drive to, like, Osborne Village that way, or that's not how you get to Portage. So writing about it at this point really does forces me to just focus on how precise or imprecise memory is, and I'm sure there's more important things, important issues beyond just like getting from point A to B that gets modified through memory.
And this is the other thing about memory too, as I'm reading the book, we really can be melancholy for times or situations that we never experienced. And I felt that reading a couple of the stories in the book, especially when you talk about, say, the old days in Vietnam, that some of these characters that have come here think about people that they've left behind. Conflict, war. It almost preys upon us, doesn't it, in our minds, whether we're of that generation even.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a, I mean, nostalgia is such a, I mean, it can almost be like a drug, you know, and yeah. It can be, I like the word you use, praise, because it can be a dangerous thing. And it's actually something, a theme that I was playing off of, memory versus nostalgia versus what is an authentic memory. And I think that theme plays out in the story of the Forbidden Purple City, because the narrator is extremely curmudgeonly and just doesn't like inauthentic representations of the past, and he blames it on nostalgia, pure nostalgia without any authenticity. I think though that I would characterize this as a positive, that memory is something that that we inherit, even if we may have not personally gone through these memories. Some of these very difficult memories that are played out in some of my stories of war and tumult, I didn't personally live through, but I do feel that I inherited in some way by virtue of my family background and my cultural background. And I think it's something that we all must grapple with. I don't think that's a bad thing, per se, to open yourself up with grappling with those memories, even though they're not personally yours.
Yeah. I mean, the whole argument like Coates poses about reparations, say,
yeah.
for the descendants of slavery. Mm. For a lot of people, they think, you know, that's not anything to consider even. But when you think about it, and you certainly talk about that with people who have come here from Vietnam after the war, this trauma does get transferred to future generations, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And we're thinking about that too with reconciliation in this country.
Yeah, no, it's transferred, and I think I use the word inherited deliberately, because whether or not you choose to inherit it, there is some sort of proprietary aspect to pain and suffering and injustice that is inherited by subsequent generations.
We talked a moment ago about home and what that means to you, having been elsewhere and then coming back. Now that you are back, you have the work that you do, and then the work you do now as a writer. Do you see yourself going anywhere elsewhere later?
I guess the short answer is no. I'm at a stage. It's kind of funny. Your question reminds me of something that I read from, I think it was David Brooks in the New York Times, about hitting your middle age. And that's kind of where I'm heading. I'm hitting my middle age, and people get into like middle age crisis thinking, oh my goodness, I haven't done the X, Y, and
sure.
Z in my life. It's
yeah.
time to think about that. But he has an amazingly, like, I think, positive spin on it. Where it's also an opportunity to realize your limits in a good way. In other words, this is what I'm about. I've been on this earth for many decades.
Mm-hmm.
These are my passions. And instead of asking yourself what else is out there, just focus on what you have and just dig really deep in what you really love. So hopefully I'm answering your question. Like, I don't have any views of somebody doing something completely different, but hopefully doing what I'm doing more profoundly.
And I guess that's the thing that you mentioned a moment ago, that wherever you've gone, this place, Vancouver, Metro Vancouver, I guess, it sort of calls you back.
Absolutely. I think that's part of it. I cannot imagine at this point being a settler in a new land, you know, and it's Vancouver has always called me back. I my wife kind of jokes with me about that, because she was born in Korea actually, and just anecdotally, I wrote a story
right.
That was set partly in Korea, and it was partly through the window of being married to my wife, who was born in Seoul, lived in New York and other places, never lived in Vancouver, but she's very different from me because she's quite comfortable now living in Vancouver, even though she wasn't born here. Mm. And she kind of jokes with me saying, like, you have this odd need to return, sort of like salmon spawning, right? To your home, whereas she doesn't feel that.
Yeah.
So I think it's a fascinating question why I feel that way. Maybe because it's a small reaction to what my parents and what the earlier generations of my family went through, being completely displaced to a new land and never being able to return to Vietnam, particularly to the place where they came from, and being extremely nostalgic about it. I have had always this luxury, even when leaving my home, to return to it at some point in time, and I'm grateful for that luxury, and I have taken advantage of that luxury.
Yeah, yeah. What you've obviously been back to Vietnam over the years. When there, does that feel any way? I don't know. Home is not the right word because it obviously hasn't been home for you. Does it feel comfortable?
You know what? I'm not sure if home is the wrong word for it.
Really?
It's not my home address. It's not where I grew up. It doesn't have all the indicia of an Orthodox home. But when I went there for the first time, it was just like I felt very strange. Like I felt I belonged there, even though I didn't.
Yeah.
It was before my first conversation with anybody there, and I was only, the first time I went there, I was only able to be there in Ho Chi Minh City for a few weeks, but I just didn't want to leave. It just felt so comfortable. It was almost like I had lived there in another life and mm-hmm. returning to it. It felt very powerful. At the same time, I do realize on a very day-to-day level what a complete outsider I am.
You feel that, and they obviously view
and
you
they
as
obviously,
that, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, I'd go around to a shop in Vietnam, and they would just assume that I was a tourist from China, right? I would, you know, even crossing the street, there's a way to cross the street. You're basically crossing the middle of a street with schools of mopeds and bicycles going in every single direction. And I didn't know how to cross the street when I first came there.
Yeah.
The key is to just walk at a steady pace straight across the street and let them go around you.
Yeah.
That's very counterintuitive. It's
almost like New York, though, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. I learned my lesson, actually. I definitely learned my lesson for one city and was taught how to cross the street in the other. So in Vietnam, like literally, like my relatives didn't trust me. I was like 28 years old, and like my aunt insisted on holding my hand the first couple of times to cross the street.
It reminds me of when I went back to the Philippines as a kid and then as an adult. I remember going there, and the minute you land, it feels comfortable to me. Unlike you, I didn't feel it was home, because it's my parents' home, I guess, because they always referred to it as home, going home, even for a vacation. But it did feel comfortable, and I guess the Philippines is odd in that part of the world, in that I guess almost everyone speaks English, that you could get around.
Mm-hmm.
But then they did look at you initially, because mm-hmm. I look Filipino,
mm-hmm.
as having lived there, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I don't speak the lingo, it became a different experience right at that moment for me and for them.
Do you go back often?
No. I mean, I've been back twice in 37 years. Mm. I mean, I don't look at it as going home anymore, because I have relatives, but they're, you know, obviously not close relatives.
Right.
I look at it like everybody else. You know, buddy wants to go there because it seems like a good place to go for a vacation.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It becomes that. You know, it becomes another tourist spot almost.
Sure. You know, it's interesting you mentioned. I don't know if in the Philippines it's changed a lot from present time to when your parents grew up there.
It has, yeah.
I know that. For example, South Vietnam, like Ho Chi Minh City, like has changed like so much. Even like the first time I came back in the early 2000s, I took my father with me,
uh-huh.
and I felt more comfortable the first time I was in Ho Chi Minh City than my father was, because he was completely disoriented, because this was not the city that he, this was not the Saigon that he knew.
Yeah.
You know, never mind that it was now communist, but just all the buildings that were coming up, and this was a time when I think they started to tear down some of the old colonial buildings, and he felt, you know, this is not the place that I know. So it was strange that I felt more at home, so to speak, in some way than my father did on our trip together.
Yeah.
It wasn't until we actually went out of the main city into the more of the countryside and the seaside where he started sort of like taking in the air and feeling, wow, this is how I remembered it.
And he would refer to it as Saigon, would he, rather than Ho Chi Minh City?
Yeah.
There's one character in the book, obviously, does that, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's still a politically fraught issue. Just the expatriates from the war, yeah, for sure.
How do you choose the stories for a collection like this? Some of these pieces have been published elsewhere. Do you keep an eye to, say, what the book will eventually look like in terms of how it represents you and your writing at this time?
Oh, that's a great question. And the answer to that is yes. One of the things that I did was I really wanted to take full advantage of the short story collection as an artistic form. And the great advantage of short story collections is that you can have like also a diversity of characters, right? Diversity of stories, diversity of dramatic setups.
Lengths,
exactly. And even though I guess the through line with my stories is the Vietnamese diaspora, I just wanted to show just sort of like the diversity of lived experience through that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure that there was enough diversity in both the types of stories, the types of characters, the types of voices, even the points of view. You know, I wrote one of the stories, the last story I wrote was Mayfly. And honestly, one of the inspirations for writing it and then including it in the collection was the fact that I didn't have a point of view that was second person.
Mm.
I had written stuff with first person, even first person plural, like me, third person. But I didn't have a you. And I actually wanted to include a story with a you, and Mayfly was the one.
Was that a challenge to write because you'd written, say, in a different voice earlier?
Only in the sense that it took me 7 to 8 years to write these stories. I mean, it's not obviously 7 to 8 years of continuous writing.
Sure.
But from the first story to the last story, 8 years had passed. So yes and no in terms of a challenge because of the spread of time between one story and the next, you become a different person 1 year to the next, right?
Yeah.
And so I would have enough distance after writing the first story. It would be months or even a year later before writing the next story. And so I was able to develop a completely new sort of voice for the next story or sensibility.
You probably already answered this, but I mean, that's one of the questions I had was deciding what narrator to use or to employ. Are you one of those writers that can change whatever you've written so that the narrator is different?
I think that there is a particular voice and a particular point of view that's suitable for a particular character.
Right.
So I do like getting under the skins of different characters and different people. But for all of my stories, I think there was a very particular reason why I chose a particular point of view. I'll give you an example. Like many of my stories, they were third person. But there were a couple that I felt more comfortable, or it seemed more suitable to write in the first person, like I. And it just so happened, I looked back on these stories. One was the first one, the investment on Dumfries Street. The other one was Turkey Day. And I think those characters actually were kind of like deadpan characters. They were kind of like straight men to like quirkier characters around them.
Right.
And then I realized maybe that was kind of like more like me, how I am.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why I used the I voice. The other time I used the I voice was when there was an extremely quirky character that's very different from me that I just couldn't do justice to unless I also sort of parroted in the first person, and that was the Forbidden Purple City. I thought that character was an immigrant, a very unusual character, and I wanted to capture it. I didn't think I could capture it other than to write him in the first person as well and sort of play him as a character.
Does it annoy you when people will say pick up this collection and even before they've even read it, ask where you are in the book? Well, we've touched on this earlier in terms of say, character in Turkey Day, the character in Turkey Day, that perhaps has shared experiences that you've had. I started reading the book wondering, not necessarily where you were, but I guess I wanted to know more about you, because there's not much about you online as I prepare for an interview.
Yeah.
Where you are in terms of just feelings and not just experiences, but in terms of personality even.
Yeah. I think I wanted to be, again, sorry for the oxymoron, but kind of like everywhere and nowhere, you know, just because, definitely I am a fiction writer. It is my passion. It is also conveniently, it's a comfort to me to be able to hide behind fiction so that I'm not literally writing about myself. But at the same time, yeah, absolutely. I've been to all the places that I've written about. I was a lawyer, in New York City, mm-hmm. around 9/11. And, well, maybe I'll give you an example to where sort of autobiography goes and where it falls
sure.
off. Like, I don't think any of these romantic, situations are about me. Like Gulliver's Wife, for example, is about a sort of like a love triangle. To my knowledge, I've never been part of anything like that. With something like Turkey Day, I did represent a lady who was going through a battered spouse application. But beyond that, the characters have nothing to do with the actual real life people I dealt with. You know, this character is a Vietnamese artist, and I've never represented anybody like that. I think superficially, certainly the places I've been to, the geography, I share with these characters. But in terms of sensibilities and storylines and sort of thoughts and feelings, maybe less so.
So you must get asked that a lot, though. I mean, what in the book is you? And is that
I don't get asked much of anything much, because this is sort of my first foray into publishing. Actually, right. I've been kind of anonymous for most of the time.
If you were asked that a lot, I mean, would it be frustrating?
I don't think so, because it actually makes me question myself, right? Where what the lines that I've drawn, and it actually gives me a bit of insight into what I've done. Like when I look back, because when I'm writing something, I just follow where the story is, and the story usually doesn't tread along with my life. But when I'm asked this question and forced to kind of think back on what I've done, I do find it interesting to try to find the breadcrumbs in my life.
In the back of the book, you mentioned Jim Wong Chu,
yes.
who for a lot of people in this town was a significant not a significant person to read, but for a lot of people that I've talked to over the years, a significant person in their writing careers. And what role did he play in your start, say?
Oh, wow. I mean, Jim was a brief but extremely powerful force in my life as my mentor. Like I didn't meet him actually until after I sent the manuscript for this collection to the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop, and he was the one who emailed me just to give me a heads up about this. And eventually, he was the one who kind of brought me out into the writer's world, you know, because before him, I was really like sort of operating in isolation as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pretty social person generally, but just in terms of the writing world,
Sure.
I haven't been part of it.
Yeah.
And he really brought me out. He would say, like, come out, meet your peers. And he just kind of called me when, you know, whenever he felt like it. And it was great. It was interesting. The last time he called me was just before I found a publisher, and it had been taking a little while to find a publisher. And he just phoned me partly to give me a pep talk, like, yeah. Oh, hey, you know, you'll find a publisher. Don't worry about it. But then he started talking about Literation, which is the festival that's held every year here, and planning for it. And they were planning on inviting an extremely eminent Vietnamese-American writer and at around the time that they were going to invite me to appear. And he just wanted to give me a bit of a pep talk. He says, like, you know, I've got your back, you know. Yeah. It's like, I know he's amazing, he's awesome, but don't feel bad about being completely overshadowed. Yeah. How do you feel about it? And I was like, no, it's awesome. It's great. It would be great to meet this person. But he was very sensitive about I guess me, and I guess that's represented. He was very, very sensitive, very conscious sort of the well-being of younger writers. And so I thought he was amazing.
That's what a lot of writers. I never got to meet him or talk to him in the 15 years I've been doing this, which is one of the regrets I guess I have. But a lot of writers, like yourself, who I've talked to over the years, have said that about him.
Yeah.
And what a huge part and what a huge loss it was.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, partly it's just because he always just shot from the hip. You know, he just tell you straight up. You know.
Yeah.
Whether something you did, you know, was not something that he agreed with or was happy with. And the thing is, he was such a tireless sort of, like, he was always so tireless. Like, he spent all this time organizing the Literation Festival, and then after the day was done, he'd invite me and a bunch of other writers just to have dinner, and I asked him, like, you know, aren't you exhausted?
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, no, this is just, I'm just feeding off this energy.
Yeah. You are a lawyer.
Yes.
How do you find the time to write?
In the cracks of my day, usually, you know, at night.
I also neglected to mention your husband and the father as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, oddly enough, now that I'm a husband and father, like I said, because I have I'm less of a social butterfly than to the extent I was back when I was in my 20s. I don't just go out and hang out as often as I do, and so my kids are relatively young. They go to bed around 8, 9 if the parents aren't looking.
Oh, they're that age, eh?
Yeah, and so usually my writing is just after they go to bed and before I go to bed. And so it's amazing how much writing I find that one can get done in just 30 minutes to an hour a day if you're dedicated.
Sure,
to
yeah.
It.
That's like reading too, isn't it? We all say that we don't have time to read.
Exactly.
If we make the time, we'll get it done, right?
Exactly. Like, I'm sometimes asked about writing tips, and I generally say, look, there's no rules because everybody's different. A short pencil might work for somebody, and a marker might work for somebody else. But in terms of my rule, it's just if you can spend like 30 minutes a day writing. And even if you're completely exhausted and just like after a hard day of work and just sitting and staring at something you wrote before, at like the hyphen that you put down,
mm-hmm.
you stare at it and have nothing because you're so tired. You never know. On minute 29, you might just come up with an idea and that changes the whole story. It's like, oh my gosh, I needed to get rid of that character after all.
What you mentioned tools, pencils and pens and the sort. How do you write?
Oh, with my iPad, actually. Yeah, I
typing on the screen itself.
Typing on the screen itself. Yeah,
really?
Yeah. I've been doing that. I did that for the vast majority of the stories in this collection. I think partly because outside of doctors, and I apologize for slamming doctors and lawyers. lawyers have probably the second worst handwriting, and so I'd write something and like look back in my notes. It's like, who was there? So I'm not a manual writer by any means.
Well, what does it feel like now that this book is out? And does it confer a burden on you to think that, say, a kid growing up now in this part of the city can look to you and see perhaps a path one day? I mean, I'm assuming that growing up here, when you did, there weren't guys that looked like you who did this.
No. I don't think of it as a burden per se. I think am a bit cognizant that a situation like that may come up, but I don't look at it as a burden. Partly, maybe because growing up with my family and my culture, there's always elders are extremely revered, but they're revered for a reason, and that's because their elders are expected to also return their wisdom, and that's sort of like the Confucian sort of background that I come from. And so this is if it so happens that somebody sees me as an elder, then that's just sort of like a natural part of the life cycle, I think. And I look at somebody like Jim Wong Chu, who just sort of gave back to those that had followed his path so openly, like and with such joy, that's kind of an inspiration to me. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not there by any means, but I don't tell myself that something like that is a burden, but it's sort of like it's a privilege to be in that position.
And the notices for this have been quite good, haven't they?
Yeah, like I was surprised I made it into the Vancouver Sun. Like I was kind of shocked. Like you don't think that, something that you're doing after the kids are asleep, that nobody knows that you're doing about would get noticed at all.
Are you working on a novel now, I understand?
I think that's probably what somebody put on the website. I'm always working on something. Yeah. I love fiction. You know, whether it's short stories or novels, I'm always working on something.
Is that because a lot of people think the short story is just a novel that's, say, shortened, I guess. You know, that's a truncated novel, if you will. Is it a different thing to write, say, a novel rather than, say, a short story?
I have less experience with the novel form, but I can say that I think the answer is yes in many respects. Like in the short story, right? And this is said by other people that you can't aim for perfection in the novel, but you can aim for perfection in a short story because it's short enough, right? So that you can get every single word right. Which partly makes writing short stories so difficult. At the same time, I think short stories are so uniquely suited to just capturing this like moment of transformation in an individual's life, which I think is sort of particularly suited to the lives of immigrants who are struggling and trying to find that one turn of fate or being dealt with that one blow. Mm-hmm. that those moments are captured quite suitably in a short story.
Who are some of the people? I mean, I'm wondering, were there writers in the family? I mean, you mentioned lawyers a moment ago. Who did you look towards in terms of say, in wanting to pursue writing as a career, as say, a role model?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not aware of any art creative writers in my ancestry. My father studied law in South Vietnam, but unfortunately he could not pick it up here in North America because his English was not good enough. I have aunts on my other side of the family who are lawyers, but no novelists that I'm aware of, although I think there are family members that have very artistic sort of sensibilities. I had a great aunt who was a painter in Paris, actually. But in terms of my heroes, they've always been other writers. When I was growing up, I just, and I still do, love, like, you know, Haruki Murakami or Kazuo Ishiguro. And when Kazuo Ishiguro won the Nobel Prize, I was like, darn it. I was like, now he's not a secret anymore. But then I thought back and realized, wait a second, when I started reading him, he had already won the Booker, so...
Or and then all these movies, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although I started reading him before the movies.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah. He's someone that I watched all those movies, and then I went back and read him. And I guess I went backwards in terms of, you know. I've enjoyed this book a great deal, and this conversation... just as much. I so appreciate you coming in to do this, and it's a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations on the book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joe.
The book is called The Forbidden Purple City. It's published by Goose Lane. Its author, Philip Nguyen, joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.